Hello. You're about to listen to one of our audio-only webcasts, which was taken from one of our popular video webcasts. We'd love to get your feedback on how valuable and effective this format is for you. After you listen, please take a couple minutes and go to www.webcastaudio/survey to complete a quick evaluation. That's webcastaudio.com/survey. Thanks for the feedback and enjoy this podcast.
Hello, I would like to welcome you to today's TechNet webcast, Security Features in Windows Vista. For more Microsoft webcasts, go to microsoft.com/webcasts. I would now like to introduce today's presenter, Sean Travers. Sean Travers has presented more than 500 live events to more than 25,000 IT professionals, partners, and resellers. As a CISA and a CISSP, Sean enjoys playing with new technologies. However, he finds helping other IT professionals solve problems and tackle unfamiliar products the most rewarding part of his job. Sean, I'll hand it over to you.
Thank you so much. I tell you, I'm excited about this. We are getting very close to the final release of Windows Vista, and I know we're all anticipating the excitement and change of, as we look forward to the launch here. And the fact that we have so many people signed up for this webcast and joining us today really drives home the point that security is going to be a fundamental concern and something we want to pay attention to inside of Windows Vista. So without further ado, let's go ahead and get started. As I go through this webcast, what we're going to do is introduce a lot of the new security functionality built into Windows Vista. So when you get done watching this webcast over the next 50 minutes or so, you're going to have a solid familiarity with what's new, what kind of things, of course, if you're in the IT world, you need to pay attention to as far as your own organization to understand how to prepare for Windows Vista, as well as integrate the product into your network now as you start to roll it out. What we'll do is first we'll start off just kind of understanding, you know, what it is that's fundamentally changed, and these are some things that specifically you might not find out about otherwise, right? So some of the underlying changes that you don't necessarily see, but they might have some impact on, you know, backward compatibility. They might have some impact on kind of the underlying understanding of the operating system for Microsoft. All right, so I'd like to introduce those to you first because that's the kind of stuff you don't see by just installing the product and playing with it or testing it. That's the stuff that goes on behind the scenes over the course of the last couple of years developing this product that will make a significant impact improving security for you, but at the same time you wouldn't necessarily be aware of it right off the bat. And then we'll go through just understanding how we can use Windows Vista to better protect our own company's resources, as well as just minimize the, you know, help desk issues and other problems that usually go along with increased security, right? So we don't ignore the real world stuff. We know that the more security you put on, you tend to have a trade-off, right? And you tend to lose usability. Well, what we're going to do is introduce new ways that you can use Windows Vista and the tools built in there to still maintain a good level of usability and reduce, in fact, help desk calls as we go forward. And then we'll close out talking a little bit about what's new in Windows Vista for anti-malware, right? Getting rid of all that spyware, adware stuff and stopping it from being installed in the future. If you have familiarity with Windows operating systems, that's, you know, XP, 2000, 98 might even help. But we're still going to be able to, we're still going to show you some stuff, even if you're not as comfortable with those older OSs. So don't feel like you have to head out. This is just a 200 level session. So we introduce you to the new stuff and drill down slightly, but don't go down to the, you know, bits and bytes level, for example, today. So if you're looking to do that, you might want to look forward to a 300 level or 400 level security webcast that'll be coming out after the product is released. All right, so first off, what are we focused on? And before I go further, I just want to say, you know, Windows Vista, and this is not just coming from Microsoft, the analyst degree is really going to be the most secure operating system that has ever shipped. There was information recently from Gartner that said specifically, without a doubt, you know, Windows Vista is the most secure operating system that has shipped. And that's a testament, I guess, to the fact that we spent so much time, so much energy at Microsoft and have continued to in the past few years focusing on security. And when it comes to Windows Vista, I think this is the number one thing we as IT pros should be aware of, is that security is fundamental to this product. It is our largest focus. I mean, now you can't say that. If you go back and look at Windows XP when it came out, security was there, but we were also looking at performance and new features. Windows 2000, we were really focused more on, you know, how can we make it more reliable? I mean, if you compare Windows 2000 to, say, you know, Windows 98 or even Windows NT 4.0, I think we can all agree it was definitely a more reliable operating system. We wanted to have that uptime. That was our main criteria. And that changes product to product. Windows Vista, main criteria, got to be security. There's a lot of other stuff going on in here. I don't want to minimize the value of the rest of the product, but this is where we spend our time, and it shows. And again, you look at analysts, you know, who normally would not be big on Microsoft, but they agree as well that security is the primary focus of Windows Vista. And so I get that question all the time: why would I buy Windows Vista? You know, why am I going to spend the money and the time to roll this thing out? And it's a tough sell to say, you know, what you should look at is the security improvements, because, you know, people don't want to pay for additional security. But there's a huge positive dollar value impact that you can directly relate to the improved security fundamentals of Vista. I don't want to sell you on the product. This is a technical seminar. I just wanted to point that out because, I mean, that's a question you're going to be asked and I'm going to be asked, is that, why do I want this product? And this is one of the big reasons. So let's go into a little more detail on it. All right. So what are the criteria? Well, one of our criteria has always been, the past few releases, has been secure by default. That means turning off things that are unnecessary, right? Unnecessary services, unnecessary drivers, whatever we don't need, getting rid of those by default. And also making sure that new security settings that should be there, like firewalls and things, are turned on, right? So secure by default means ever having it, having the operating system install in a way that's not going to expose you security-wise. And so that was one of our focuses here. So how do we do that? Well, one way is by improving what we call our software development lifecycle, right? So we have to focus internally at Microsoft and specifically in Seattle as they're developing the product on security throughout the development cycle. If you don't spend your entire lifecycle focused on and looking at security at every step of the way, you're going to miss something. And so the developers at Microsoft now have specific requirements around how often they must attend a security class and how frequently they must troubleshoot and security test each other's code, right? So every year, minimum, they have to take a new, brand new security test in class, and they also have to trade their code with other people on a monthly basis to find out exactly what security flaws might exist in new code they've written. So this is, again, depending on where we are in the life cycle, this is going on in one form or another throughout this process. That was not the case prior to, you know, Windows Vista, and prior to earlier products, we weren't really as focused on security. If you look at IT in general, before, go back to 97, 98 time frame, security was not a primary concern. It was starting to be, but it really hadn't. And now we're really focused on it heavily. And then the common criteria. So we look at the certifications of operating systems out there and what common criteria are necessary to maintain a secure OS. And we do incorporate anything there that we can. So that certification will be going on in Windows Vista as we release it. Of course, you can't certify, you know, an operating system for meeting that common criteria security standard that the government stipulates until the product's released. So we will be doing that, though, as we did with Windows XP as well. All right. Now, this is one of those things I was talking about that you really don't know about behind the scenes, right? In addition to the SDL, the Software Development Lifecycle, here's another thing that's really fundamental to the product, though, that is something you wouldn't normally know about, and that is the Vista Service Hardening component. And if you look at, and again, helps to compare it to previous OSs. If you look at Windows XP, right, we didn't really spend a lot of time worrying about whether a service was performing the actions that it was supposed to. We essentially, for example, take the Blaster example. Remember the Blaster virus? Right, so Blaster essentially took over the RPC service. And what it did was it forced RPC to write executables to the run command, okay, It also forced it to write to the registry and then also send information out over the internet. Now, RPC is a remote procedure call, right? It should not have been performing any of these activities. Why could it do that? Because, again, security, you know, wasn't necessarily the primary focus when we wrote previous OSs. With Windows Vista, however, we had to step back and take another look. Things like Blaster shouldn't be able to happen. So we revamped the code. We looked back at all of the services that are built into Windows, and we said, no, okay, what tasks should this service perform? If it performs a task that it doesn't need to, let's block that, right? So let's stop it from performing any tasks that it shouldn't need to as part of a normal course of day-to-day activity, right? So Blaster, if you know, it had just, if we just had Windows Vista service hardening alone, would have been completely stopped from doing anything. And this is going to help, you know, don't look back, right? We always look forward when it comes to security. That's what you have to do, right? Say, okay, what new exploits are going to come out? Well, it's going to greatly minimize the potential of new exploits, right? The potential of attackers, I call them attackers, you can call them hackers or whatever you want, of attackers, right, to find ways to get Windows to do things, right, for their specific virus, for their specific worm. It's going to block those kind of things. All right, so specifically, we looked at the services, RPC, you know, the time service, the built-in, you know, all kinds of other services, right? And we said, now, what activities should these be performing? And then we locked it down. And we actually also blocked these services from being able to talk to one another or take each other over, right, to perform actions on their behalf. So let's take a look at the kind of the different steps here that have to go on. So first off, we kind of reduced the size, right, of the different layers. So if you look at the, you know, the user layer on the outside here, what you want to do is to have a number of layers protecting the outside world from getting into the kernel, right? So we reduce, not only do we add additional layers, the admin layer, for example, the services layer, but we also reduce the size of the high-risk layers by pulling stuff out of the kernel and moving it up through the layers. Does that make sense? So by pulling stuff out of the kernel, the actual attack surface of the kernel is smaller, and it also brings activities that shouldn't be performed at the kernel level, where, by the way, not only do you have security potential risk, but also greater reliability risk, right, as far as keeping that machine up and running. Things like, for example, I'll give you a perfect example. Number one cause of blue screens, hardware-wise, is what? Graphics drivers. Yeah, bingo. Graphics drivers, graphics cards. Why? Well, a lot of the reasons. First off, they're very hard to write prior to Windows Vista. And the reason they're very hard to write is because they have to do so much brute force work. Well, cool, couple cool things. So Windows Vista not only helps that out, right, by taking care of a lot of that with the new Aero Presentation Foundation, it takes care of a lot of the activities that the drivers would normally have to perform. So it improves the reliability of that, and we also pull those drivers out of kernel mode and move them up into user mode, right? By moving them up into user mode, the potential for security breaches and blue screens goes away. So a huge benefit of moving drivers out of the kernel layer is going to improve reliability, but also improve security. So both of these things, you very rarely have these kind of win-win situations. Well, we do have a win-win situation here. And so let's take a look. What else can we do? Well, not only do we reduce the size of those high-risk layers and segment them out, but we also have the ability to increase the number of layers. So we even have low writes programs now that kind of run out there around the user layer, out past there, where we have now put our drivers. So user mode drivers are pushed out. Other drivers that used to be kernel level are now user mode. And so we've done a number of things at this potential layer. For example, services used to be able to kind of take each other over. Did you know that really having a firewall prior to Windows Vista that blocked outgoing connections really didn't do a whole lot of good? And why is that? Well, if I was blocking an outgoing connection for a specific service, let's take the RPC example again. So I'm blocking RPC from communicating out through my network card. Well, what RPC could have done in Windows XP is just say, well, all right, so what service is talking out over port, you know, over that network card? And maybe it would say, oh, the HTTP service, right? So I'll go talk over port 80, right? How do I do that? Well, RPC would just say, hey, HTTP, can you please, and here it is just talking to another service, can you please perform this action for me, send this packet out to this website? Yes, thank you very much. And then HTTP would dutifully take care of that for you. Well, the issue is blocking RPC from having a connection outbound connection to the internet really hasn't done any good there, has it? Well, with Windows Vista, what we do is we say we block that communication between RPC and HTTP. Unless it's a necessary communication, we're going to stop that communication from happening. And therefore, RPC is segmented, isolated within itself. It can't call up another service to perform some action for it. Therefore, outbound filtering on the firewall works. And so it's a whole bunch of really, really positive things that happen security-wise because of this service hardening. You're not going to know about it right off the bat, right? You're not going to install the product and go, wow, service hardening is really helping me out. Long-term, reliability and security benefits are going to be huge. All right, enough said. I just wanted to really introduce you to that because we spent a lot of money and time thinking about this, and hopefully you'll see the benefits long-term. All right, what else do we need to focus on? Well, we know that the majority of viruses and spyware adware that gets installed on my machine happens because I am browsing the internet. A very simple day-to-day task like browsing the internet should not be a big security risk, right? We recognize that. We apologize for what happened in the past. We're going to do our best to fix this, right? And the great thing about IE7 is when installed and used in conjunction with Windows Vista, we have some huge potential benefit. You can buy, right, you can get and for free, right, a number of other browsers out there and install them onto Windows Vista. The problem is Windows Vista does not work, right, in conjunction as well, right, with some of these other browsers. So IE7 is designed specifically to tie into a lot of the Windows Vista stuff. Now, these other browsers, they have the potential, right? We've given those APIs out, but they're not there yet, right? They probably will be down the road, but for the best security today, you can talk about IE7 and how well it ties in with Windows Vista. And what we have here are a number of social engineering protections that we've done. So just take a look at the social aspects of it. Windows Vista and IE7 have a phishing filter and a colored address bar, so that you'll know, well, I didn't do a very good job on my circle there, but you'll know if a phishing site is suspect, right? If you're clicking on a link and that link for some reason does not seem quite copious, right? Quite copacetic. Maybe it's the link that specifically is the URL that you're going to doesn't match up very well with the actual DNS name of what's showing in your browser window. Or maybe there's a invalid character in there. Maybe it's pulling in content from all over the globe and really just not behaving very well. Well, IE7 can detect that and will let you know, hey, I think this might be a phishing site that you're about to go to. So it will color the address bar and let you know, either yellow or red. Yellow means I think it's a phishing site. Red means I know it's a phishing site. How does it know? It knows because it's been reported back up to Microsoft from the community. That's you, right? You and me. We report back up to Microsoft. Microsoft says, oh, I think that does look like a phishing site, right? And we determine, you know, and verify that it is. Then we send that back down to IE7 and let everybody know from now on that is definitely a phishing site. So phishing filter is a good filter, and it will get better as time goes on, as it learns more and more of the phishing sites that actually exist out there. It also notifies you I think there's some dangerous settings here. There's a potential for a problem here. So those phishing sites like the bank websites that are faked, right, that are spoofed, they're trying to get you to enter your bank password and username, those are going to be, going away. They're not going to be as effective going forward if we use this IE7 and Windows Vista. If you look at any website that tries to get you to enter in your credit card info, those could all be phishing sites as well. In fact, the going rate on the black market for a credit card number you know, with expiration details, is about $100. That's a lot of money. When you talk about a good fishing site that might pick up, you know, thousands of people a day, that's a lot of money. And so there, people are spending a lot of time and effort trying to make these fishing sites work. So we need a solution that will actually, you know, improve itself going forward. And this, that's specifically what IE7 was designed to do. Secure defaults for international domain names. IE7 adds the ability to have international, in other words, different languages in the domain name now. That was not really possible before. So as we add different languages to the domain name, we increase the potential for spoofing, right, potentially. So take, for example, Microsoft.com. If someone wanted to spoof Microsoft.com prior to IE7, they might swap out, say, a 1 for an I, right? So the I in Microsoft would switch to a 1. That worked okay, but it's pretty easy to tell, you know, if you see a 1 in there, that it's probably not the Microsoft site. Well, think about all the additional potential for international spoofing, right? Umlauts, right, get added in. Accent graves, accent aigu, whatever you got, right? So all these different subtle, small changes get added into the browser domain names, potentially spoofing, helping to spoof those sites. So by supporting international domain names, we've also at the same time paid attention to the potential for phishing and social engineering in that, and that we will now help to identify whenever a non-English character appears with an English character, oh, well, that might be a potential issue. And so we'll identify that as a dangerous setting. Now, it takes a number of different dangerous settings for it to actually become a suspected phishing site, but so that'll improve going forward. What else? Protection from exploits. So, you know, unified URL parsing, the code quality improvements through the software security development lifecycle, the SDL that we talked about earlier, has been in full force in IE7, more so than maybe any other part of the product. We'll continue to, as we have been, moving towards a more secure ActiveX environment. So now, ActiveX, right, it's a very incredibly powerful solution for browsing the web. That's why Microsoft loves it so much. You can do anything you want to with ActiveX, right, computer-wise. The challenge is that also opens the door for attackers. And so what we've been continuing to do is we've left ActiveX, you know, as part of the OS and part of IE7, we've been reducing the default characteristics of it as we go forward through the various operating systems. So what IE7 and Windows Vista does is it says, okay, ActiveX is now an opt-in feature. So at this point, you don't get any ActiveX unless you say you want it. And how does that work? Well, let's say it's a signed ActiveX control. What you can do then is you'll just get a prompt that says, by the way, you're about to run ActiveX. Do you want to allow it or deny it? If it's an unsigned one, we'll give you a couple of different warnings. First, we'll tell you, by the way, this is unsigned, very risky to run it. And secondly, do you want to go ahead and do it? Now that you've said that you're okay with an unsigned ActiveX in this situation on this website, do you want to go ahead and run ActiveX, right, for this, install this control? So, and then, you know, it goes forward from there. The more suspicious the ActiveX control becomes, the more opt-in you have to do. And we're pretty smart about what the messages are. They're pretty people savvy, right? In addition, so to protect us additionally from exploits, right? There's so much IE7 does. It's amazing. This is probably the biggest one that, you know, it's the easiest one to talk about, I'll say that, because it's protected mode. It makes sense in my mind. Everything clicks. When I think protected mode, what I think is I'm preventing malicious software from installing. So any of that malware out there that normally gets installed through websites, it's about 2% of links, right, on suspicious, you know, searches. If I search on pirated software, if I search on, via, you know, MSN search, I'm doing a search for maybe celebrities, right? The links that come up there, if I click on those links, and this was a study done by CSO Magazine, by the way, Chief Security Officer Magazine, they did a study and they just did these kind of random searches for celebrity sites and things like that. And then they clicked about 2 to 3, I can't remember exactly the number, but layers or levels into these websites that came up as the search results. And what they found was about 2% of those sites installed and they, you know, installed some form of malware, right? Seems actually pretty low to me, but that's what they came up with. But that's still a lot. You think about 2%. Every 100 links I click on, I'm going to get 2 pieces of malware. That's pretty significant. So what protective mode does is it says, well, anything that tries to install from the web will only actually be installed with specific action from the user. So you can't just click on a link anymore and have it install into the run command or into the registry, right, or install into the start menu, okay? So these viruses and things aren't going to be able to automatically install. You're going to get prompted every time software tries to install from the web. In fact, protected mode says goes even farther. It says, by default, things can only get written into temporary Internet files. You know that temporary Internet files folder you have? We've locked that down significantly, and that's where everything from the web now goes with IE7 and running on Windows Vista. This is one of those Windows Vista-only kind of functionality, right, at this point, until the new, you know, browsers come out, right? So what it says is temporary Internet files, you can't execute anything from temporary Internet files. It's only for caching and displaying stuff. So you cannot execute an installation from there. If you want to execute an installation, you save the executable somewhere else, and then you run it, right? But so protective mode, by default, nothing browsing, no links you click on the web will be able to install anything. It's a beautiful thing. It's a beautiful and simple solution. I like it. Can you tell? I love good security. All right, let's move on, shall we? How do we get advanced malware protection? Well, with IE6. Okay. Advanced malware protection. We don't have it, right? So IE6 essentially installs a driver and runs Windows Update. Exploits can install malware at this point, right? So when they're writing to these different various registry keys, like HKEY local machine program files, IE6 lets other programs be able to install into there, right? HKEY current user, my documents. This is all protected by that protected mode in IE7. Caching web content, cached temporary Internet files, untrusted files and settings can go in there, they can execute. Not good to allow stuff to execute from there, not good to protect it. And so we're isolating that temporary Internet files too. Things can't just kind of traverse out of there. This is a plus for us. So what happens in IE7? Well, we essentially implement what's called a compact redirector, right? So everything is redirected to temporary Internet files. You can't put it somewhere else. We enforce integrity control to verify that information hasn't changed. We never really did integrity checks prior to IE7, right? And then we also force this IE admin account to install the ActiveX control. It's not done by the user account, which is where we used to, what we used to do before. So the IE admin account, as you can imagine, is a little different from a user admin account. You can only put stuff in certain places, can only execute certain types of code, blah, 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 blah. So we pay attention. So installing an ActiveX control, the HKEY local machine program files, is done specifically by IE admin. IE user is the account that Internet Explorer 7 will use for changing settings, saving pictures, untrusted files, right? So this temporary Internet files is where IE user writes to. If it's a redirected setting or file, goes to untrusted. It does not ever, can ever translate itself into a trusted file or setting. All right, I'm going to have to move a little quicker here. So ActiveX, opt-in. By default, unchecked. You've got to check it off if you want to opt in. All right, so here's kind of where that appears. By the way, here's your phishing filter is configurable. That's a new setting inside of the advanced tab here on your internet options. And then if you drill down this list, you'll see the option for turning on and off ActiveX. So by default, you can see allow the installation of ActiveX controls that have invalid certificates is automatically turned off. ActiveX opt-in, if IE7 is blocking an ActiveX control, the user grants permission or opts in, says run or don't run, the ActiveX control becomes enabled. Again, only that specific control, only on that specific site. IE7 confirms, by the way, if it's been granted, it confirms that you want to do the install, as I mentioned, a couple of different steps there. This protected mode, well, we already addressed this, right? Talked about what protected mode is. Things get written to temporary internet files. They used to be able to write to places like /temporary internet files/startup or wherever they might have gone before, startup folders, other locations in the file system. Again, using the user permissions, can't do that anymore. Can't do that at all. Protected mode will stop that from happening. Now, you can turn off protected mode, and then you can write wherever you want to. Not recommended, right? No real security benefit to doing that at all. In fact, it's a security risk without really any necessary benefit. Phishing filter compares, again, a couple of different ways it works. First, it compares the website with a local list of known legitimate sites. If it doesn't see it in the list, it still scans that website for characteristics that are common to phishing sites. If it finds it is common to phishing sites, it will give you that yellow, right, title bar. And then it double checks online with Microsoft to see if it's a reported one as well. So it takes several different steps. So it double checks to see if it's got the latest details. It does all this very quickly. I already showed you the different. I already talked about the different address bars. If it's phishing, you'll get the kind of the red shield with the X in it. You get the yellow shield if it's just suspicious. All right, enough said. Let's talk about the Windows Firewall for a minute. We know now that Windows Firewall can do incoming and outgoing right protection, and it does this actually through a built-in service known as IPsec. This is a standard that Microsoft has adopted. The Internet Protocol Security Standard, IPsec, was developed by lots of different companies. It's a very smart way to create firewalls. And by tying it in with IPsec, we allow for a lot of functionality that wasn't there before. Specifically, a lot of new group policy settings come out of this. So as an IT admin, we can configure down to the very nitty-gritty level. In fact, I'm going to show that to you in just a second, so I won't belabor the point here. I'm going to show you how we can configure a great deal of the firewall stuff through group policy. In fact, here's kind of what the console looks like. This is the advanced console, so most end users aren't going to see this level. We don't want them to. We just want them to run the firewall kind of with the default configuration and allow stuff as necessary. This is the console the IT admins are going to spend time looking at. So let's just take a quick look at this. So I'm going to share out my desktop here, give you guys a chance to see kind of some of the different settings that are available. And if I bring up my console, right, here's my firewall. This is the one we just saw via screenshot. And I've just brought it out to you so you can see it a little bit better. The connection security rules, inbound or outbound. You can see I have no connection security rules currently. What I have is the firewall turned on and then some inbound and outbound exceptions. But if we take a look, we can create a very simple connection security rule to configure how an application is able to talk out to the Internet. It's a very simple thing. And then besides just talking to the Internet, you can see we can configure how they could talk, how my machine could talk to another machine. That would be, for example, server to server. It could be server to server, or it could be desktop to desktop, right? Well, we know what that means. That means two machines talking to each other. Isolation says restrict connections based on authentication criteria. So don't allow any connections unless there's been some authentication that's already happened. Just because I have the port opened up, don't specifically allow that connection to happen. You're going to say, well, okay, I want to authenticate all connections except for these specific servers, right, or these specific workstations, or this specific domain. Anybody in this domain can talk to this machine without any authentication. So this is all about the authentication security that you want to have. Tunneling allows authentication connections between gateway computers that might talk through an untrusted network. Right? So tunneling automatically to me in
Excuse
my
me,
mind.
Sean?
Yes.
I'm just seeing a black screen now.
That's not good. When did that
pause
happen?
This?
All right. Well, I apologize for the delay there, folks. We're just trying to troubleshoot what might have happened, and it looks like what we're going to have to do is bypass these demonstrations, at least the first one here. We'll try it again on the second demo. If it doesn't work, then we'll just bypass them. The good thing here is these demos are not intensive. You could easily walk through the steps that I was going to do. All I did was open up the Windows Firewall. To do that, just go to, if you have Windows Vista running today, just go to Start, click on the Start Search, text entry point there at the bottom of your start menu, and then just type in firewall, and you'll get what I go into is the advanced Windows Firewall settings. Right, Windows Firewall with advanced security is specifically what it's called. And so I just opened that up. I was going to configure a connection security rule. The different types of rules, as I mentioned, are isolation, authentication, exemption, server-to-server, tunnel, and then a custom rule. And I was just going to go through and create a custom rule. There's about 5 to 6 different steps in the wizard there, and specifically create an exception for, say, a given program like Windows Media Player or PowerPoint Viewer, right, to be able to do that display across the web. And then for inbound rules, to show you there are a number of default rules that are built into Windows Vista. That's what I was going to show. And the default rules allow you to enable these things very simply without having to spend a lot of time and effort, because we know that an individual application might talk over 3 or 4 or 5 different ports. It can be very confusing and time-consuming to set all that up. So we have it built in to our firewall, allowing you to easily turn that stuff on if you need to, like the Office Communicator that will be coming out, Office Groove, right? Some of the different instant messaging tools, right? Not just Microsoft stuff, but others. So you can turn these things on and off, meeting space, peer-to-peer communication. All right, so these are different inbound rules. I was going to create a custom inbound rule to specifically allow some communication, just to show you what that looks like. So you're not missing out on anything huge. You're just going to go in and configure the firewall. All that stuff, by the way, that I talk about is configurable as well via group policy. Bingo. That's the beauty of the demo, to talk about, you know, how we can bring all this stuff to bear in our internal networks very easily without spending a lot of time and effort. I know there's still a lot of people out there. We don't enable firewalls on the workstations. I totally respect that. That decision is yours to make. But I also would point out that the spreading of viruses and worms and things could easily be suspended in most cases simply by turning on that firewall. And if you have a good, easy to manage firewall, like Windows Vista is going to be, Windows Vista adds about, I don't know, a couple hundred additional possibilities for easily configuring your firewall over what Windows XP had. And so the benefit here is it's easy to configure, easy to set up. Once you do it, your workstations are going to be in good shape. Now, there's a lot of management overhead potentially if you've got a lot of different applications out there, but still a plus. All right, let's talk about Windows Defender a little bit. What we have with Windows Defender is essentially the Microsoft anti-spyware tool that was in beta, and a lot of people downloaded it. We have millions of downloads, one of our most successful ever, right, free downloads. And, in fact, I think it was the most successful ever. And what we did is we just incorporated that tool with some minor changes for Windows Vista into the product, right? So it's built into Windows Vista. It's called Windows Defender. It allows for improved detection and removal of not just, you know, spyware, adware, but also any other unwanted software. It's a redesigned, simple interface to use. And some people actually argue it's too simple, like to have it a little more advanced, right? But the concept here is make it easy for people to block this kind of spyware, adware stuff. And then it goes beyond that, right? It also looks at currently running applications, applications from any of my startup locations that are starting up as the computer starts up. And it allows me to block those. It allows me to identify applications that are currently using my network card, right? So if a virus gets on my machine, one of the first things it always does is take over, use the network card. It's very easy to isolate because there's not a lot of applications that are going to be using, right, my network card like that. So I can easily identify, oh, I see, you know, Outlook is currently accessing the network card, and so is IE, and here's some other application. Let me guess. If I don't know what that other application is, could it be something I might want to block? Right, so it makes it pretty easy to block out stuff that might be risky, right? It allows protection for all users. Right, and it's just a simple little tool to use, but it's a hugely powerful one. Network access protection, this is a new feature for Windows Vista that I wanted you all to be aware of. I don't think you're going to take advantage of it immediately. This will take a little bit of testing and time and effort on your part to make sure it's done properly. But this is just the next logical step to what we had before, which was called VPN quarantine. Right? VPN quarantine said, if you VPN into my network, I'm going to isolate you to a quarantined area until we have verified that you are okay. What do I mean by you are okay? Well, your workstation or laptop, more than likely, that you're VPNing in with, has to be configured with all the latest security updates. So latest patches, latest hotfixes, latest antivirus signatures, latest anti-malware, spyware stuff, right? So if all that stuff is configured properly, then I will then take you out of quarantine and give you an IP address that allows you to route to the rest of the network. Well, all we did with network access protection is say, well, we need that same functionality, and we need it for any machine that connects to our network at any time. This is a pretty huge change, right? So when a Windows Vista client comes in, either via VPN or DHCP or some maybe router, we're going to isolate it with a separate IP address. Network proxy server can talk to it, but the rest of the corporate network can't talk to it right away. And so what we'll do is we'll say, for the time being, while you're in quarantine, you can talk to these fix-up servers and get your updates, get your latest signatures, and get all that stuff onto your machine. Once all that stuff gets back to the workstation, right, we'll set that to come back to the workstation, then we'll give you a new IP address, and bingo, you can talk to the rest of the network through, you know, your typical routing path. All right? So policy servers get you the latest policy, right? And so you have to run that script. Once you get the script, run the latest policy settings. If everything checks out, you get on the rest of the network. Yes, there could be some latency involved here. It could be some delays, people getting on the network. Do I care? No, right? As long as it's not significant enough to keep that user from being able to do their job that day, I don't really care, because the most important thing is they're getting on and they're secure and I can trust that machine. People coming on your network, not always trustable, right? And so we need to be able to trust that. Let's talk about controlling identity access. Kind of one of the current challenges that we have around identity access is that people are overprivileged, right? And so what we see is people writing to locations they shouldn't be able to write to, running applications they shouldn't be able to run. That's a problem that Windows Vista takes a lot of effort and a lot of time to address. And how does it do it? Well, a couple of different ways. One way is we actually have implemented something called user account control. And user account control essentially says, hey, if you're logged on as a standard user, say, we're going to prompt you for credentials whenever you try to run and perform an administrative task. That is simple. That is obvious. That is just like the run as command. Right? All we're doing is providing the run as command by default. Big deal. Now, here's the big difference. If I'm logged on as an administrator, right, or with my elevated privileges on that machine, I will be prompted to perform administrative level activities then as well. Now, I won't, by default, I won't have to enter my credentials again, but I will hit the button that says continue. So all we're doing with Windows Vista in this case really is just saying, helping you to identify when you are performing administrator level stuff. So guess what? You know, even though it couldn't happen with IE7 because of the way IE7 works, if I actually clicked on a link in IE7 and I saw a pop-up that said, by the way, you're about to perform an administrator level task, guess what? I might be very suspicious of that website, right? If I was just clicking on a link to try to open a static page, I should not have been prompted. In fact, IE7, by the way that it works with protected mode and everything else, you'd never see that. This is what's known as layering, right? So we've got security layers. So if you ever see that in IE7, boy, you really want to be suspicious. But if you ever see that with any other application, it might be trying to install a virus, right, onto your machine. Or maybe you've downloaded a simple little program and you try to execute it and that program pops up with the user account control pop-up. Well, now you know that program that I thought was a simple little program that shouldn't be doing anything administrator-wise is. Maybe that might be some type of adware, spyware type thing. Maybe it's installing a keylogger. I don't know. The point is now you have the ability at least to be aware that that activity is going on. It does. We also use user account control for some other reasons here. And one is, this is a pretty big one, I love it, registry and file virtualization. Sounds very fancy and important. And in fact, it's hugely important in its security impact. What it says is all these administrator level registry keys and things that a normal standard user wouldn't have access to now are set up on a per user basis. So each user has their kind of own settings, so they can only really infect their own account, and it's only while that account is logged on anyway. And so what we do is we virtualize the secure files, like the program files directory, we virtualize that on a per-user basis. So when I'm logged on with my account, say Sean T, you know, at Microsoft.com, I log on with that account, I'm redirected off to my special set of program files directories, and I can make any customizations and changes I need to the applications, and it'll go to this place. Huge impact positively, right? One is I can lock down this program files directory, this virtualized program files directory. I can also lock down the original program files directory even more, right, than I did before. And any changes I make will only affect my account. And I have the potential really to fix that stuff. If I log in with another account, I come in and fix it. So there's a lot of big positive changes. Same thing goes on with the registry. A lot of registry virtualization going on. Shouldn't really break any applications. The application is never really aware that it's not going to the place that it thinks it is. If it's a really poorly written application, there is some potential there, but for breakage. But in general, it's going to be a good situation for us. Here's an example of that user account control that I talked about. Here you can see I'm inside of the system panel, and so I'm in the advanced system settings. And if I want to click on a button like this one, change settings, or say backup and restore, which is another administrative level task, I'm going to get prompted with user account control. Here's kind of how it'll look. This, by the way, is a little bit outdated. It looks a little differently today, and that's fine. But this will give you the basic concept behind this. Let us say, you know, say maybe I've clicked on the disk cleanup wizard and I'm logged in as a basic user. Well, then I get this prompt over here that says, hey, if you want to do this, you've got to give me some administrator level credentials. Very similar to run as. Let's say I'm logged in as an administrator and I do some administrator level activity. I still get prompted. This is we'd see instead of Windows Security at the top here, you'd actually see user account control at the top there in the title bar. But then you get kind of an allow and deny functionality. And it depends upon whether or not the application is signed or unsigned, or maybe it's an operating system application, as to what this kind of prompt looks like. And so you get kind of the red bar as you go across to an unsigned application. We get more and more risky. Look for red inside of Windows Vista. Anytime you see red, you might be doing something you shouldn't be doing. All right, we're going to try this one more time. I'm going to try to demonstrate user account control, and I'm going to share out my desktop, and we'll see if we get the black screen. I'm hoping Eric will pop up and let me know. I'm sure he will.
Hey, it's a black screen right now. I actually got feedback from one of our attendees that they were seeing it just fine while the rest of us were not, so it was very interesting. I'm seeing a black screen right now.
All right, so for that one attendee, here we go. I'll click on, say, local security policy. Do you see a pop-up here? Probably not.
Let me check.
No, probably not. That's because user account control actually freezes up the other applications while you're performing that activity. And that's the designed impact.
I'm seeing this now, Sean.
You are seeing that?
Yes.
So local security policies come up?
Mm-hmm.
Awesome. All right, so that's kind of what I want to do. I want to come in here, talk about the different security settings. That's good. Hold on a second. Then I actually don't want to go to that console. Right, we want to actually drop in here and show you some of the different settings you can change. So what you can do is come in under administrative templates here, and under your Windows components, you can configure some of the user account control settings to say exactly what the pop-up will look like, when it will come up, when it will not. You know, actually, I'm time constrained here as well. So just to show you, some of the user account control settings can be found via group policy as well. Glad you can see that, though. That'll help with the next demo.
Yeah, that's good. Thanks.
All right. Look forward to having here.
And thanks to everyone for your feedback on this, too.
Yeah, and your patience.
Yeah, I got a lot of feedback, and people were able to see it, so great.
Awesome.
Thank you.
All right, so some of the improved auditing. And we'll spend a little more time on that demo when I come back to it in just a minute. I just want to get through these slides very quickly. Auditing has been vastly changed. For one thing, I regret to inform you, if you have all of your auditing numbers memorized, as well as, you know, your event IDs in Windows, like failed logon attempts and things, you'd have to re-remember them. Right, they actually changed. We had to renumber the audit events. In other words, all the event IDs that come up in the pop-up messages and in the event logs, because we added so many more. We added more. Adding more is good. It's a good thing for all of us. It means we have more detail around what's gone wrong. We have more messages. So whereas before you might have just gotten one message for a failure, now you might get three messages leading up to that and then the final message. So your event log is a much richer tapestry of the details of the problem that might have gone on. We're exposing more information to you. As an administrator, you can see that info. You can go in there and you can manage what happened, right? And so to improve the auditing, not only did we renumber and create new event IDs, but we also went in and set up improved events for registry access use of administrative privilege, file, these are the kind of things we've added, file system access. All this new logging infrastructure breaks down auditing in a much more logical and understandable way. Now, this is one that's gotten a lot of airplay. I personally don't think it's as big of a deal, but it's going to be really beneficial for some companies, and that is we allow you to, essentially we've changed how the GINA works, right? The GINA is that graphical identification and authentication DLL. This determines what the pop-up is that you see when you do, like, for example, Control-Alt-Delete when you're logging on. So when you go into WinLogon, you can configure and create a whole new GINA.dll for your end users that looks and feels the way you want it to. Not only that, you could do that before, but now you can customize your own login, right? Your own login functional behavior. So if you want to say, you know, log in with a smart card, you want to log in with, you know, a custom retinal scanner that you created, you know, whatever login device you want to use, you can create the GINA to do that. This is a good thing for security. It means you can get to whatever layer of security you want to for configuration of these steps. So Windows Vista now replaces that GINA DLL and allows you to customize that more fully. This is just, we're going through all these things. Plug and play smart card support. So plug and play with a USB smart card device, very easy to do, very quick to do. You can see I plugged in my smart card in this situation, immediately have access to manage that device, manage those settings via group policy, configure the new interface for log on with that device, and you get the integrated control for the end user. So another thing we did, you know, besides what we talked about earlier, which is to use user account control for access, we also given the end user more permissions than they had before. This is where you might want to come back if you were drifting away from the webcast, because this is pretty critical. In order to get better security, this is one of those weird situations where we've actually given a basic user more permissions. And this is because a lot of applications that we used to have to run with administrator level privileges would break under a basic user. Microsoft knows that when you run as a basic user, you are automatically just hugely more secure. Probably in my mind, the number one security thing you can do today is to run as a basic user. And with Windows Vista, we're going to help you to do that by making those applications not break as often. How do we make those applications not break as often? We give the end user more permissions than they had before. Lots of little things, like, for example, changing the time zone settings. Now, we still don't want an end user to change the time of their machine, because that has a huge security impact, right? Not to mention, least of which are on the log files, for example. So we don't want the end user to change the time of the machine, but we don't really care if they change the time zone. So we've given that permission to the end user in a typical install right of Windows Vista. Another example is, you know, being able to install devices like USB flash drives, install printer drivers, install, you know, scanner drivers. These kinds of things typically were, again, required by applications. Therefore, we were making people standard, making people administrators of their own machines in far more cases than made sense. So there's just a couple of little examples, but what you want to be aware of is that the end user has more permissions and that, by the way, you also have control over their new permissions. So I can use group policy. One of the new ones I just mentioned was control over removable device installs, the ability to kind of restart a machine, simple little things like that that really shouldn't be a huge deal, security center enhancements as well, so being able to see that information. You can come in and actually turn that stuff back off via group policy. So if I want to block unauthorized devices, let me try this one more time here. So this is where we'll go back and spend just a second in here.
We are seeing that, just so you know.
Well, that was quick. Good.
Yeah.
All righty. And I want to show you how I got to this point. So I just created a new Microsoft Management Console, right? And then I added the the local computer policy, or you can add group policy management, right? So you can manage your domain level. By the way, the GPMC is built into Windows Vista by default. You don't have to go and download it. The group policy management console that you use to manage your domains is built into Windows Vista. Anyway, let me expand out my system here. And there's a new setting inside a system. This is my system group policy called device installation. And so device installation restrictions, here's one that you want to be aware of. Prevent installation of devices not described by other policy settings. So you can come in here. If you're one of those people that say, wait a second, I don't want my end users installing their own printer drivers. I'm not quite sure why you would say that. I could argue against it in a lot of cases. But if you don't want them to install the printer drivers, you can come in here, enable this, and they'll be back to not installing any flash drives, not installing any printer drivers, not installing any scanner devices, not installing any new hardware really on their machines. So I'll just enable the prevention of the installation of those devices. So you would want to hit OK there. You can also come in and specifically allow only certain devices. The problem is this is not going to be terribly functional. I'm just being one of those honest guys, right? For a lot of us, because it really requires an intimate knowledge of the device IDs in your networks. So, if you want to spend some time learning the device IDs, and by the way, it's not some not a very typically. Let me show you an example here. Allow installations of devices using drivers that match these device setup classes. You can enable that. Come in here and show the different setup classes. Look, you don't have a lot of information here about them. Add, you have to essentially go to that device manufacturer and I ask them exactly what their device installation ID is. All right, and it varies from, believe it or not, not only device to device, but manufacturer to manufacturer. So just because you're installing a USB scanner driver doesn't mean you could just have one class ID. You actually have to look at each manufacturer, HP, Lenovo, whoever else is making these devices, and find out their specific IDs. It's not exactly uniform. So here's an example of a GUID or a class ID. And by the way, you can just do a search out there online, and there are a number of blog sites that kind of talk about it, but there's nobody that gives a kind of comprehensive list of all these different device IDs. All right, so I'm just being honest. So typically what you're going to do is you're going to set people up to the standard user and you're going to let them install their own device drivers. If you don't want to do that, here's the other option. Prevent install of devices not described by other settings. So those are the big changes around the device installation stuff. And so I just wanted to kind of bring that to bear for you. Give you a heads up as to what's coming down the road. Now you can kind of make better decisions potentially about how to plan for, the new permissions for standard users. So data protection is done a little bit differently. We still have encrypting file system for any NTFS drives, and we've really enhanced that significantly. As we move forward, NTFS matures, we get a lot of new potentially improvements there. You might be looking for something called WinFS. If you remember when we initially started building Windows Vista, we had something called WinFS. We did not actually implement the full WinFS platform, right? So the new file system was essentially passed over for some other changes that we wanted to make into the Windows Vista product. But we brought in a lot of the functionality from WinFS, which is awesome, into the new, the NTFS builds. One of those is, for example, BitLocker drive encryption. You can actually encrypt your entire Windows Vista drive, your entire hard drive, using this BitLocker technology. Therefore, how would we then read that drive? Well, we need an encryption key, right, or a decryption key, which is stored on a local TPM chip, can also be stored on a USB flash drive. A TPM chip is only available on certain hardware, so you have to make sure you buy hardware with a TPM chip. Stands for Trusted Protected Module. This is a standard that Microsoft is adopting. And so what it allows you to do is encrypt your entire hard drive. If I have a laptop that keeps sensitive information on it, I don't know, the Veterans Administration comes to mind with 21 million names, I might want to protect that laptop with BitLocker. So provided I actually know that laptop exists and that user is taking home those names, right, with all this, important social security number data and everything, date of birth and all that stuff, So then I would just say, well, I'm going to encrypt your entire hard drive just to be on the safe side. Encrypt the entire hard drive. Therefore, that laptop gets stolen. Someone tries to read that. They cannot. They cannot read it. Why can they not read it? Because I've encrypted the entire drive. So they try to dual boot. They're not going to see anything on that drive, right? They can't read it. It looks like an unformatted drive. If they try to, you know, install my drive as a slave to theirs, can't see anything on it. You can even set it up as well with a PIN number so that even to get past, you know, the initial BIOS, you would have to enter a PIN number. In that case, they wouldn't even be able to get to the login screen, right? So it would be totally protected machine, nothing you can do. So that's kind of one of the big data protection benefits or changes that you'll see going forward. Other thing is, we besides encrypting file system and BitLocker protection, one of the other big ones I like to talk about for data recovery, which is actually part of security when you think about it, having access to data, is the shadow copy stuff that's built in. So shadow copy used to be a server level only thing. Well, now it's also built into the workstation. I can go to the properties for any file that I want to and look for a previous version of that file on the previous versions tab. All right, and so it'll keep previous versions up until a certain percentage of hard drive space. And that's, again, configured and defined by you. All right, so worry-free hardware repurposing if you need to, ability to let the laptops go with important confidential data on them, be comfortable that they're okay. This is going to be a very, very secure deployment. We talked to people at the Secret Service. They don't have any way to crack this at this point. Nobody does. In fact, the one thing they asked us for when we talked to them is they said, hey, I'd like to have a way to break into BitLocker. And I said, we had to say, thank you very much for all the work that you do, protecting us from child pornography and other things, but we cannot provide a back door. So this is the 100% secure way to go if you want to protect your data on your drives. You can still use encrypting file system. That does a great job protecting individual folders and files, but it's not going to get to the level that BitLocker is protecting, you know, even all the way down to, you know, page file and the Windows DLLs and everything, right? So BitLocker goes the extra step. Here's a BitLocker drive you're trying to read from another installation. You can see that I can't read it. It looks like the drive is not even formatted. Not accessible either. Try to read it, not accessible at all. The TPM chip, cheap little chip, but does a whole lot of work. Runs on that workstation or that laptop. Let me get rid of my drawing here. Essentially stores the encrypted volume key. It stores the full volume encryption key. So essentially this TPM chip stores the key information and passes that off. And it's actually pretty quick. You might think it'd be a very slow process to encrypt your entire drive. The performance impact is relatively minor. This is, again, hardware-level encryption, so it's very quick. There's been a number of things done in the standard to make the performance good as well. Almost done here, second to last slide. Just take a look at the spectrum of protection when it comes to BitLocker. You can use TPM only. It's incredibly easy to do this. It will encrypt your entire drive. Excuse me, I'm trying to talk so fast, I'm losing my voice. It tries to encrypt the entire drive, and it does, right? But there's no PIN protection, so someone could still boot that drive and get to the login screen. It's still better than no protection at all, quite a bit better. But the security is not as high as, say, with a dongle, right? So if you use a dongle instead of TPM, well, now you've got to have physical access to the dongle as well as the laptop. So you've got to have physical access to two things. We know in the security world that means it's more secure. Ease of use goes down a little bit, though. If you lose your dongle and it's the only thing that's got the key on it, right, and we also call these, you know, USB flash drives. That's what I was talking about earlier. If you lose this, good luck getting access to your machine, right? So if you lose the USB flash drive, it's like creating a denial of service attack against yourself. Pause for laughter. Okay. Now you can use the TPM with a PIN. That's extremely secure. As soon as you add that PIN, it says you can't even boot that device without it. You can use TPM and dongle. This is the most secure way to go, right? If you don't have the TPM chip or the dongle or the laptop, you are out of luck, right? So this is the most secure way to go. So to summarize what we talked about, Windows Vista, definitely most secure operating system, not only Windows we've ever shipped, but anybody. And I'm not just saying that to brag or anything, it's just a fact. We spent more time on security, spent billions of dollars working on it. It's going to be the most secure OS out of the box. You know, second thing is you want to be aware of just some of the new features, some of the gotchas, the changes of the permissions for the user accounts, the user account control stuff that you might want to turn on and off. Just be aware, if you don't like the prompts, you can turn them all the way off, right? So you don't have to see these prompts if you don't want to. All these prompts can be turned off. I like to leave them on. I think they're good to have. I think they help me security-wise, but it's up to you. Windows Vista, all it's trying to do here is not only lock down its own services and lock down its own internal gears and switches and everything else, make sure it's secure, but it's also trying to protect us from ourselves. All right, so the browsing the web and all the other things we do that are security risks, it's trying to let us know, hey, by the way, this might not be a good thing. So it's protecting us even from some social engineering attacks like phishing. So there's a number of things Vista does within itself and for us. And I hope you found that there's a very comprehensive approach here that we're trying to take, a multi-layered, secure-by-default approach. And I appreciate you staying around for the whole webcast. So thanks again to everybody who joined us today. I'm going to pass it back over. I want you to please complete the evaluation form. Let me know what I'm doing well. Let me know what I'm not doing well, and I'll fix it for my next time. Thank you very much.
Okay, yeah, I have posted the survey. I encourage you to fill it out. I encourage you to use the all other registrants option. That one should work for you. But that does conclude today's TechNet webcast. Thank you for joining us. You may now disconnect from the audio portion of this conference.
Hello, thank you for listening to this webcast. We value your feedback, so please take a couple minutes and go to www.webcastaudio.com/survey to complete a quick evaluation. Thank you.